Radical love, lavish generosity, extravagant forgiveness, inclusive hospitality, compassionate action, selfless service, a passion for justice, creative nonviolence, simple living. Good day, good people. I'm Robert Farrell. This is Coalesce. Thank you for joining me. Coalesce is grounded in both and thinking, heart wisdom, and listening for the common good arising in dialogue, where we are present to presence. Coalesce provides an opportunity to encounter and discover the multiple perspectives that make our beautiful community. May we see with the eyes of our heart. May we love one another with peace and compassion. May all beings come to know the divine presence within. This is episode 18, The Way. As we see in Jesus and Paul, Christianity first emerged not as a new religion, but as a form and sect of Judaism. Wherever Paul, Peter, Mark, Thomas, and other early missionaries traveled, they formed small communities of believers in the Way, a movement that emphasized Jesus' teaching, death, and resurrection as the path to transformation. Members of the Way clearly believed that Jesus was the Messiah, although that had many different meanings. Gradually, the movement grew and took on a life of its own, welcoming non-Jews as well as Jews, becoming more inclusive and grace-oriented, and surely less tribal, until it eventually called itself Catholic or Universal. By the year AD 80, there were Christians as far away as India and France. The early church period, the 500 or so years following Jesus' death and resurrection, was a time of dramatic change in culture, politics, and economy for the ancient Mediterranean world. All of these changes affected the development of the fledgling religion, shaping liturgy, rituals, and theology. Diana Butler Bass writes, "For all the complexity of primitive Christianity, a startling idea runs through early records of faith. Christianity seems to have succeeded because it transformed the lives of people in a chaotic world." End quote. During this time, Christianity was not so much about doctrines or eternal salvation, but about how to live a better life here and now within the reign of God. From the Romans' perspective, the Christian sect was radical because it encouraged alternative behaviors that were both attractive and threatening to the worldview of empire. Rather than acquiring wealth, sharing possessions equally. Rather than segregation, living together with people of different ethnicities and social classes. Early Christianity, one of the key building blocks in my lineage of faith, is largely unknown and of little interest to most Western Christians. The very things that early Christians emphasized, such as the prayer of quiet, the Trinity, divinization, universal restoration, and the importance of practice, have been neglected to our own detriment. Every time the church divided, it also divided up Christ, and both sides of the divide were weaker as a result. As happened in the year AD 1040, the schism between what are now known as the Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholic churches, we, in effect, excommunicated one another and we were all losers. That is what dualistic thinking always does. I hope we will reclaim these forgotten pieces of the Christian tradition for our wholeness and blessing. we are still carrying the DNA of our great-great-grandparents of faith, and knowing that can give us deep identity and meaning. Not knowing this heritage will allow you to cling to superficial Christian distinctions that emerged much later and largely as historical accidents. The early Christian values. Much of what Jesus taught seems to have been followed closely during the first several hundred years after his death and resurrection. As long as Jesus' followers were on the bottom and the edge of empire, as long as they shared the rejected and betrayed status of Jesus, they could grasp his teaching much more readily. Values like non-participation in war, simple living, inclusivity, and love of enemies could be more easily understood when Christians were gathering secretly in the catacombs, when their faith was untouched by empire, rationalization, and compromise. Several early writings illustrate this early commitment to Jesus' teaching on simplicity and generosity. The Didache, written around the year AD 90, says, "Share all things with your brother, and do not say that they are your own. If you are sharers in what is imperishable, how much more in things which perish?" End quote. The Shepherd of Hermas was written around the year AD 120, and it gives the image of the church as a tower to be built of white round stones. Many of the stones are not suitable for use in construction. Those stones are not rejected, but they are put away to one side. These stones represent believers who are still relying upon their wealth and success, and therefore cannot build this new community. They cannot be used until they have been reshaped by the gospel, and their reliance upon money and success has been taken from them. Around the year AD 175, St. Clement of Alexandria wrote a letter entitled, "Can a Rich Man Be Saved?" The very fact that it was posed as a question lets us know that Jesus' teaching was still taken seriously. St. Clement concludes that it is not necessary to renounce all your worldly possessions to be a believer, but it is surely questionable and dangerous to be rich. If greed is not warned against, it almost always takes over. Usury, the taking of interest on loans, remains a mortal sin until well into the 12th century, when the first middle-class tradesmen begin to emerge. Tertullian, another recognized father of the church, writes around the year AD 200, "If anyone is worried by his family possessions, we advise him, as do many biblical texts, to scorn worldly things. There can be no better exhortation to the abandonment of wealth than the example of our Jesus, who had no material possessions. He always defended the poor, and he always condemned the rich." End quote. I am not making a political economic judgment here, but illustrating how Christianity has indeed changed with the times. There are good and bad aspects to these changes. Let's try to hear the important truth that is present and read such statements from the early Christians with wisdom, prayer, and a non-dualistic mind. They can only make us wiser and more discerning. Take a moment now to connect to that important truth. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. The last great formal persecution of Christians in the Roman Empire ended in AD 30. 10 years later, Christianity was legalized by Constantine. After this structural change, Christianity increasingly accepted and even defended the dominant social order, especially concerning war and money. Morality became individualized and largely sexual. The church slowly lost its free and alternative vantage point. Texts written in the 100 years preceding 313 show it was unthinkable that a Christian would fight in the army, as the army was killing Christians. By the year 400, the entire army had become Christian, and they were now killing the pagans. Before AD 30, the church was on the bottom of society, which is the privileged vantage point for understanding the liberating power of gospel for both the individual and for society. Overnight, the church moved from the bottom to the top, literally from the catacombs to the basilicas. The Roman basilicas were large buildings for court and other public assembly, and they became Christian worship spaces. The Christian church became the established religion of the empire and started reading the gospel from the position of maintaining power and social order instead of experiencing the profound power of powerlessness that Jesus revealed. In a sense, Christianity almost became a different religion. This shift would be similar to reversing the first of the 12 steps, to seek power instead of admitting powerlessness. In this paradigm, only the winners win, whereas the true gospel has everyone winning. Calling this power spiritual and framing success as moral perfection made the position all the more seductive to the ego and all the more disguised. The failing Roman Empire needed an emperor, and Jesus was used to fill the power gap, making much of his teaching literally incomprehensible and unhearable, even by good people. The relationships of the Trinity were largely lost as the very shape of God. The Father became angry and distant. Jesus became the needed organizing principle. And for all practical and dynamic purposes, the Holy Spirit was forgotten. An imperial system needs law and order and clear belonging systems more than it wants mercy or meekness or transformation. By the grace of God, saints and holy ones of every century and in every denomination and monastery still got the point, but only if they were willing to go through painful descent, which Catholics call the way of the cross. Jesus called the sign of Jonah, Augustine called the Paschal Mystery, and the Apostles' Creed called the descent into hell. Without these journeys, there's something essential you simply don't understand about the very nature of God and the nature of your own soul. You try to read reality from the side of power instead of powerlessness, despite the fact that God has told us, through the image of the crucified, that vulnerability and powerlessness is the way to true spiritual power. But Christians made a jeweled logo and decoration out of the cross when it was supposed to be a shocking strategic plan charting the inevitable path of full transformation into God. All spiritual knowing must be balanced by not knowing. As the Christian church moved from bottom to top, protected and pampered by the Roman Empire, people like Anthony of the Desert, John Cassian, Evagrius Ponticus, and the early monks went off to the deserts of Egypt, Palestine, and Syria to preserve Christianity, keep their freedom, and to keep growing in the Spirit. They found the church's newfound privilege, and the loss of Jesus' core values unacceptable. It was in these deserts that a different mind called contemplation was first perfected and taught. They came to see contemplation alone could understand spiritual things properly. The desert fathers and mothers gave birth to what we call the apophatic tradition, knowing by silence, symbols, and not even needing to know with words. It amounted to a deep insight into the nature of faith that was eventually called the cloud of unknowing, or the balancing of knowing with not needing to know. Deep acceptance of ultimate mystery is ironically the best way to keep the mind and heart spaces always open and always growing. It really does work. Today's scientists might call it moving forward by theory and hypothesis, so you are always ready for the next new discovery. We need enough knowing to be able to hold our ground, and I hope I'm offering a bit of that here in these recordings, a container and structure in which you can safely acknowledge that you do know a bit, and in fact, just enough to hold you until you are ready for a further knowing. In the meantime, you happily exist in what some have called docta ignorantia, or learned ignorance. Such people tend to be very happy, and they also make a lot of other people happy. We are all burdened by know-it-alls. It is amazing how religion has turned this biblical idea of faith around to mean the exact opposite, into a need and even a right to certain knowing, complete predictability, and perfect assurance about whom God likes and whom God does not like. It seems we think we can have the infinite mystery of God in our quite finite pocket. We know what God is going to say or do next, because we think our particular denomination has it all figured out. In this schema, God is no longer free, but must follow our rules and our theology. If God is not infinitely free, we are in trouble, because every time God forgives or shows mercy, God is breaking God's own rules and showing shocking but merciful freedom and inconsistency. Take a moment now to connect to that shocking freedom and mercy. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. I'd like to take a few minutes to reflect on the Desert Fathers and Mothers and the early Eastern Church, and at a later date, I'll talk about these more. The men and women who fled to the desert emphasized lifestyle practice, an alternative to empire and its economy, psychologically astute methods of prayer, and a very simple, some would say naive, spirituality of transformation into Christ. The desert communities grew out of informal gatherings of monastic monks, functioning much like families. A good number also became hermits to mine the deep mystery of their inner experience. The desert tradition preceded the emergence of systematic theology and the formalization of doctrine. Faith was first a lifestyle before it was a belief system. In some areas, like Alexandria in Egypt, you had to be a long-standing monk before you could be a bishop, which entirely changed the character of bishops. These early monks and bishops were probably the first link from the desert period to what became the Eastern Church with its unique insights. Since these desert monks were often uneducated, they told stories instead of using formal theology, much like Jesus did, to teach about essential issues of ego, love, virtue, surrender, peace, divine union, and inner freedom. But later, they also became much more formalized and argumentative, just like the church in the West. Thomas Merton brilliantly recognized the importance of this early desert form of Christianity. He describes those who fled to the wilderness as people, quote, who did not believe in letting themselves be passively guided and ruled by a decadent state, unquote, who didn't wish to be ruled or to rule. He continues, saying that they primarily sought their true self in Christ. To do so, they had to reject the false, formal self fabricated under social compulsion in the world. They sought a way to God that was uncharted and freely chosen, not inherited from others who had mapped it out beforehand. Can you see why we might need to learn from these desert fathers and mothers? In addition to the desert fathers and mothers, I particularly value the wisdom of the Greek-speaking theologians in early Christianity, the fathers of the Eastern Church. These names would be known in a Western seminary and some church calendars, but they would not be familiar names for most lay Catholics or Protestants. Origen, Athenaeus, Basil, the two Gregories of Nazianzen and Nicaea, Evagrius Ponticus, John Chrysostom, Pseudo-Dionysius, the two Cyrils of Alexandria and Jerusalem, and many others. Their writings were formative in the early development of Christian theology, some of which we've retained, and unfortunately, much of which we've forgotten. Early Eastern Christianity set the foundation and ground for what we now call contemplation. The term hesychasm means resting in God, and it applies to the primary concern in the Eastern Church. The Western Church was always more missionary-oriented, more practical, and also focused on academic learning. That made a big difference in our two approaches, and obviously there are strengths and weaknesses to both. Our biggest loss was that we did not balance one another out. Among many of the early fathers, there is a common belief in apokatastasis, universal restoration, that has largely escaped the Western Church. Most Catholics and Protestants would be shocked at their early belief that salvation is cosmic and universal, and that this is the precise and perfect meaning of Christ's victory. While this early belief is validated by Scripture and by the very Trinitarian nature of God, the Western Church went down the road of a very limited victory for God, a reward-punishment understanding of salvation at which no one won, including God. Both desert Christianity and the Eastern Fathers of the Church are essential, yet almost lost pieces of the great perennial tradition. They are foundational to retrieving true orthodoxy, or rightness, a word not used by Jesus. The early church, in its simplicity, non-liturgical emphasis, and non-hierarchy, was itself an alternative to what was later called orthodoxy. It focused on very different things than the church did after both East and West aligned with power, money, and war. All streams of the great tradition have something to teach us. We exclude or neglect them to our own detriment. By reclaiming the many divergent roots of our faith tradition, we come closer to experiencing the wholeness and union that God surely desires for us and offers to us. Take a moment to experience the wholeness and union with God. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. The practice this week is called concrete participation. As we can see, most of religious and church history has been largely preoccupied with religious ideas about which you could be wrong or right. When faith is all about ideas, you do not have to be part of it. You just need to talk correctly about it. You never have to dive in and illustrate that spiritual proof is only in the pudding. The spiritual question is this: does one's life give any evidence of an encounter with God? Does this encounter bring about in you any of the things that Paul describes as the fruit of the Spirit? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, truthfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Galatians 5:22. Are you different from your surroundings, or do you reflect the predictable cultural values and biases of your group? The participatory turn is learning from concrete practices, personal disciplines, and interactive dialogues that change the seer and allow and encourage the encounter itself. Many Christians today are discovering prayer beads, prayer of quiet, icons, contemplative sits, tizay chants, charismatic prayer, walking meditation, Zen chores, extended silence, solitude, and disciplined spiritual direction. Up to now, you could have a doctorate in theology as a Catholic or Protestant and not really know how to pray or even enjoy a prayer, experienced union. Although you could recommend it officially to others and maybe even define it, now we know that we must personally live our faith. I hope you will dive into your faith and experiment with ways of opening yourself to transformation, to encounter, to conscious participation in God. Concrete participation is the way. Thank you for being with me. May truth and wisdom bless and protect you. May you know the divine face as your face and be a beacon of grace. May you know the divine face as every face and bring peace to all you meet.